This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, April 18th, 2006. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert, sitting in for Aldo Bogado. China's president arrives in the United States. India's prime minister meets some demands from Bhopal disaster survivors. And we'll hear why South Africans are concerned about free trade negotiations. These stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue has signed into law a new set of immigration measures. Known as the Georgia Security and Immigration Compliance Act, the law requires all persons over 18 years of age to prove their legal residence to receive services provided at the local, state, or federal level. Anyone receiving state benefits must sign an affidavit regarding their citizenship or legal immigration status. The law also requires a 6% state withholding tax for all workers who cannot document their legal residence. Trained police officers at the state level will also be authorized to perform federal immigration enforcement and customs duties. Former Enron executive Jeff Skilling remains on the stand today as his cross-examination continues. Lisa Cohen reports from the Enron trial in Houston.
The former president and CEO has responded to a broad range of questions, including his own calendar entries, with, quote, "I don't recall." When prosecutor Sean Berkowitz asked about Enron's fourth quarter 1999 earnings release, which is alleged to have been changed at the last minute per Skilling's order to meet Wall Street analyst expectations, Skilling asked, quote, "Was I in town that day?" Skilling also denied, then qualified, requesting a lessons learned meeting in the summer of 2000, which reviewed Enron's poorly performing asset portfolio. Many of those assets ended up in the Raptors, the off-balance sheet vehicles that were hedged with Enron stock and hastened the collapse of the company when the stock price fell in 2001. Skilling will likely remain on the stand through the week. From KPFT, I'm Lisa Cohen.
The Environmental Protection Agency has released its latest report on greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. While optimistically pointing to a slight decrease in methane and nitrous oxide emissions, the report shows an overall increase of over 15% from 1990 to 2004. Fossil fuel combustion accounts for over 80% of the total emissions. The report is part of a requirement under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Oil prices hit a record high of over $72 a barrel today. Analysts cite fears about Iran's nuclear program and possible cuts in supply from the world's fourth largest crude exporter. This, as reports suggest that Venezuela could soon be considered the new world leader in oil reserves. Mike Fox has more from Caracas.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez says that if OPEC formally recognizes his country's extra-heavy crude deposits, Venezuela will surpass Saudi Arabia as the world leader in proven oil reserves. According to BBC journalist Greg Palast, an internal study from the U.S. Department of Energy has determined that Venezuela could have reserves of over 1 trillion barrels. This news comes as the Bush administration is exerting increased pressure on oil-rich Iran over the development of its nuclear program. The Venezuelan government has publicly opposed any military action against Iran. Meanwhile, the Venezuelan paper 2001 reported that U.S. intelligence claims to have discovered the existence of a secret agreement between Iran and Venezuela, whereby Iran will send nuclear weapons to Venezuela and Cuba. This morning, Venezuelan Minister of Foreign Affairs Ali Rodriguez Arraque called the claims part of a chain of absurd accusations fired at Venezuela over the past few years. Caracas has denied various rumors of the past year that Venezuela is sending uranium to support Iran's nuclear program. Mike Fox, FSRN, Caracas.
Buenos Aires city officials impeded unemployed workers, known as piqueteros, from inaugurating a soup kitchen in a city neighborhood yesterday. Five demonstrators were arrested and several injured by police. FSRN's Marie Trigona has more from Buenos Aires.
Police arrested piquetero leader Raul Castells during the opening of a soup kitchen in primary school in a chic Buenos Aires neighborhood yesterday. Castells' group, the Independent Movement of Pensioners and Unemployed, or MEECT, planned to open a soup kitchen in the central flea market that had been closed down for safety violations. Police violently evicted demonstrators while they tried to enter the flea market. Castells was arrested on charges of aggravated destruction and robbery. Castells spent several months in prison on similar charges last year for taking over a McDonald's restaurant, demanding hamburgers for the unemployed. Meekt recently opened a soup kitchen in the exclusive Puerto Madero, the most expensive neighborhood in Argentina. Meanwhile, human rights groups blocked a central intersection to mark International Day in solidarity with political prisoners and to press for the release of some 20 political prisoners currently held in Argentina. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Chacona in Buenos Aires.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
In Iraq, clashes with insurgents continued for a second day in the neighborhood of Adamiya, that's in northern Baghdad, where there have been frequent attacks against U.S. troops and Iraqi government forces. Elsewhere in Baghdad, a bomb killed 7 people in a restaurant and 12 bodies were found in various neighborhoods, apparently victims of either militia or government executions. FSRN's David Enders is in Baghdad and files this report.
The fighting began early Monday morning when guerrillas bombed a joint U.S. and Iraqi army checkpoint. The ensuing gun battle lasted between 5 and 12 hours, according to varying reports, and left at least 2 fighters and an unknown number of civilians dead. Local residents, who have recently armed and organized themselves to protect against the threat of raids by Shiite militias, also reportedly fired on Iraqi police and army. By nightfall, the neighborhood had been largely sealed off. Adamiya is a Sunni neighborhood known for its support of Saddam Hussein. In 2003, the former dictator made his last appearance there before fleeing Baghdad as U.S. troops entered the city. Abu Hanifa, the neighborhood's landmark mosque, holds the tomb of a venerated Sunni imam, and the mosque itself has been raided half a dozen times by U.S. and Iraqi troops during the last 3 years. Clashes broke out again this morning, and by this afternoon, Adamiya had been sealed again by Iraqi police and army, and U.S. troops were providing backup to Iraqi army units on search missions inside the neighborhood. Some residents reported that utter confusion reigned as they were caught in a multi-sided crossfire. Others said that neighborhood residents were simply defending themselves against further incursions by Shiite militias allied with the Iraqi police. Arrests in Adamiya by Shiite-led security forces have been common during the last year, and Abu Hanifa was attacked by militiamen following the destruction of the Askariya Shrine, which holds the tomb of a Shiite imam, in February. Sheikh Omar al-Jumaili is the director of the Human Rights Office for the Iraqi Islamic Party. Jumaili defended the right of the residents to take up arms, pointing to a diktat from government officials last month urging residents not to cooperate with Iraqi security forces unless they were accompanied by U.S. troops, because of the problem of militias posing as Iraqi police and military, and actual infiltration of militia members into the security forces.
There was an order 2 months ago from the Ministry of Defense and the American troops that if there are any groups trying to attack or capture people from anywhere, that people should not cooperate with them.
Other residents say that clashes between Iraqi police and Adamiya residents have become more common in recent weeks. In the words of one resident, the police are fired on any time they try to enter Adamiya. One resident of the neighborhood says 3 of his friends were killed and that he expects more violence in the coming days.
The local people who fight, they were nearby my house with their RPG and all of them were nearby my house.
The local people fight near my house with their RPG and their Kalashnikovs. There are bullet casings in my yard and my daughter is playing with them. 3 of my friends were killed.
The man says that at least 7 people have been killed since the fighting began.
Yesterday, 6 people, and today, 1, and more injured. At least 30 people have been injured.
This afternoon, as happened yesterday, fighting ended only when U.S. troops entered the neighborhood. A large-scale attack also took place against U.S. troops on Monday in Ramadi, the provincial capital of Anbar, the most violent province in the country. U.S. troops battled guerrillas for 90 minutes. The city was reportedly quiet today. In Baghdad, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh announced he will make some concessions to survivors of the 1984 Bhopal gas disaster. The announcement comes days after Bhopal city residents marched 500 miles to Delhi and began a hunger strike. In 1984, a pesticide plant owned by Union Carbide leaked 40 tons of toxic gases in Bhopal, killing 3,500 people immediately and another 15,000 in its aftermath. As many as 600,000 people have been harmed by the spill, and the World Health Organization determined last year that the amount of contamination in Bhopal's water supply is 500 times the recommended level. Spill survivors are demanding a full cleanup. Pragya Vats is a volunteer with the International Campaign for Justice in Bhopal. She told FSRN's Leanne Caldwell that Bhopal residents have only gotten some of what they want.
In terms of the demands, the rest of the basic demands which people wanted, yes. But on the issue of corporate accountability, which is the larger issues, I mean now, with the kind of in the globalizing era. So that is one of the things which government has been dodging.
So you talk about corporate accountability. Pragya, will you talk about the demands that the people of Bhopal wanted that the Prime Minister did not agree to?
It's basically the Kordao accountability and the cleanup issue, which he said that he would not take a stand against the multinational because India needs investments and all of that. I mean, I would just read out from this news item which we have, even people like one of the Satyanath Sarangi, he's one of the six persons who were in the hunger strike. He actually said, to quote him, I would say, that we are ashamed and outraged that the Prime Minister of the world's largest democracy has openly admitted to his inability to pressure an American multinational. And this is one of the points which has been highly disappointing for the Bhopal survivors.
Is there anything else that are missing in these concessions?
Basically, it's an issue of corporate accountability, which is primarily missing. But the larger headway has been on the health concerns. But it's only you'll have to wait and watch and see as to what extent it actually actualizes and is implemented on the ground level, though.
Then what did the Prime Minister say he will actually do then?
He's agreed to kind of release some money on the scientific assessment of depth and spread of toxic contamination in and around the Union Carbide factory in Bhopal. And also, he has assured of funds to address all health issues related to contamination. And, of course, the safe drinking water, which has been a long-pending issue, because in the Supreme Court verdict of May 7, 2004, they have basically issued directives to the state government to provide clean drinking water, which had not been heeded to so far. So I think this is one of the not a breakthrough, but rather just a kind of pending issues which has been cleared in more clear terms from the government quarters.
And the Prime Minister also said that he will build a clean water pipeline to the city of Bhopal. And
that's what the Supreme Court verdict also said. I mean, but nothing was done so far because of discrepancy between the center and the state. But now, hopefully, I mean, since it's been promised by the Prime Minister's office, so we kind of trust that and, I mean, you know, basically, rest some trust in that and credibility, thinking that this would happen at least this time around.
And why do you think the Prime Minister agreed to something now? The people of Bhopal have been demanding a cleanup, have demanding their access to clean drinking water and a non-contaminated living environment for two decades. Why now?
That's a very kind of interesting question because this has been one of the long-standing movements and one of the longest struggles so far in India. And the point is, there's been a lot of international pressure as well. And just to kind of share with you, this congressman, led by Frank Fallon, and 20 other congressmen had sent a letter to Indian Prime Minister seeking an urgent kind of intervention in the Bhopal thing. So these are some of the international pressures which were being built. And of course, the media attention this time around had been really, really overwhelming. So I think, and besides, these people had marched all the way from Bhopal to Delhi.
That was Pragya Vats of the International Campaign for Justice in Bhopal speaking with FSRN's Leanne Caldwell. Chinese President Hu Jintao arrives in the United States today. He'll dine at the mansion of Microsoft CEO Bill Gates tonight, and he'll meet with President Bush on Thursday in Washington. In the nation's capital, Yan Meixi takes a look at what both sides will be pushing for.
Hu Jintao's visit will be his first to the White House since he resumed the presidency in China. As the U.S. has long watched the rapid rising of China with unease, and the Congress has been disgruntled with China's trade policy. President Bush has a long list of issues to discuss with President Hu. Derek Mitchell is the Senior Fellow of Asia Projects at the International Security Program, Center for Strategic and International Studies, an organization with strong ties to the government and the private industry.
Starting with the economic issues, the issues of trade, of intellectual property rights, of currency valuation. North Korea, want to make sure we get China to play along, North Korea, bringing North Korea to the table, Iran. And for this president, the issue of religious freedom and human rights is always very critical.
As the U.S. has an annual deficit of more than $700 billion and growing, issues in trade will be front and center. Last week, a group of Chinese policymakers came to Washington, D.C. to meet with cabinet officials ahead of talks between the nation's two top leaders. The Chinese government agreed conditionally to further open up the Chinese market to U.S. products and to strengthen the intellectual property law enforcement. White House Press Secretary Scott McLennan says those commitments from China are a good start.
Those were important steps that were announced by China. And now we want to see those steps implemented.
Derek Mitchell says tough talk may be the only leverage the U.S. has on China, and Mr. Hu may simply brush it off.
So if the U.S. is not happy or resentful, I don't think he's that concerned, really. In fact, I think there's a little bit too much complacency in the Chinese government that there's not much we can do about it, that we are so codependent that anything we do is going to be counterproductive for our own interests, trying to do to China.
Philip Swagel, international trade and a financial policy scholar at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, says to overcome the barriers in trade talks, both sides have to move beyond harsh language.
They understand that they have a long list of economic issues that you know, things that we want from them, and they're working on it. And from their perspective, they're saying, look, we've got this financial sector that's, you know, got more scotch tape on it than you can imagine, and, you know, we're working on cleaning it up. If we move the exchange rate, the whole thing will you know, come undone. So you need to understand our limitations.
As one of the five permanent members at the UN Security Council, China plays a pivotal role in pressing Iran to drop its nuclear programs. China and Russia oppose UN sanctions against Iran. State Department spokesman Sean McCormack says, despite China's reluctance to punish Iran, the U.S. and China can still seek common ground.
I can't believe that China wants Iran to have a nuclear weapon any more than the United States or the European countries or Russia.
However, Dan Blumenthal, an Asian scholar, also from the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, says the U.S. holds limited leverage to press China on the issue of Iran.
Well, the only leverage is sort of the moral suasion, the moral persuasion issue. So you say, you know, look, the entire world, it's not just the United States, it's the EU, it's countries, it's other countries in the Middle East don't want this to happen. And are you going to be the only outlying country that wants this to happen?
After trade and national security, human rights is likely to be another issue on President Bush's agenda. Derek Mitchell.
Privately, frankly, the president is very strong on human rights and religious freedom. And some people in the administration have even said that if he had his way, that's all he would talk about.
When Mr. Hu arrives in Washington, D.C. on Thursday, he will be greeted with a full military honors reception and the full 21-gun salute that befits the head of state. But Mr. Bush decided not to accord Mr. Hu a state dinner. Instead, only a social lunch will be hosted by the U.S. first couple. I'm Ye Meixie for Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C.
The Chinese president's visit to the United States is also hot news in China. FSRN's Severine Bardone reports that China's priorities for this visit seem to be far away from those of the United States.
As Chinese President Hu Jintao is set to begin his state visit to the United States, China is focusing on several issues that might be slightly different from what Washington is expecting. Qin Linbo is a member of China's Institute of International Studies, a think tank linked to the Foreign Ministry.
Three sources of tension remain between China and the U.S. The first one is the question of Taiwan. Maybe the United States doesn't see it as the most important one, but if this issue is not handled properly, relations between China and the U.S. won't be able to stabilize. The second point is the commercial one, which includes several aspects such as trade deficit, property rights protection, money revaluation. Of course, these questions have been debated many times, but they could become hot topics, even though the two countries are willing to have a dialogue. The last point is security. Beside the Taiwan issue, the main remaining problems are the nuclearization of Iran and North Korea. But on this topic, China and the U.S. have had the same position for a long time. If relations between China and the United States become strained, it will be because of one of these three issues. We also have several historical disagreements which have not been solved, such as human rights or the religious situation in China. But I think the dialogue will go on these topics, and they won't cause any problems or threaten the relations between our two countries.
The White House hasn't mentioned Taiwan as a major topic of discussion for this visit, but it seems that China has high expectations in this matter. Jin Linbo details China's point of view.
I think the main issue for China is Taiwan. China's major objective is that the United States does not send the wrong message to Taiwan leaders. Maybe Taiwanese people have the idea that the U.S. supports the idea of independence. Before, we insisted on reunification. It was our most important duty. Now we don't focus on reunification, which nevertheless remains our ultimate goal, but we insist on opposing Taiwan's independence. Between the Chinese position, opposing independence, and the United States one, which could accept a status quo, there are several common points and moderate positions. If during the state visit, China and the U.S. could find even more common ground between their two positions, I think it would benefit the interest of both countries.
In February, China threatened to invade Taiwan if its leadership declared independence. This after Taiwan President Chen Shui-bian sidestepped discussions with China on reunification. At the same time, the Chinese military has built up its short-range missile capacity along the Strait of Taiwan, a 98-mile-wide waterway that separates the regions. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Séverine Bardon in Beijing.
President Bush has announced he will nominate U.S. Trade Representative Rob Portman to head the Office of Management and Budget. Susan Schwab, who is currently Portman's deputy, is expected to replace him as the top U.S. trade official. Meanwhile, in Johannesburg, U.S. trade representatives are continuing their three-year-long negotiation of a free trade deal with the regional South African Customs Union. FSRN's Selena Masuda reports that many South African activists are concerned about that agreement.
After a long Tuesday, the United States and members of SACU failed to agree on a finalized free trade agreement. The United States' lack of flexibility on three issues brought the negotiations to a standstill. At a press conference held on Monday, Deputy U.S. Trade Representative Karan Bhatia stated that the U.S. will not compromise on investment, government procurement, and intellectual property rights. Some opponents of the intellectual property rights terms, like Jonathan Berger, a lawyer for the Treatment Action Campaign, a South African HIV/AIDS activist group, say that the agreement will hurt the public health of South Africans. According to Berger, the group plans to challenge any trade agreement with the United States that would allow the United States to control the rights of the country to provide generic drugs to South Africans as well as import them to other countries.
We have committed to take whatever legal means are at our disposal to block any future agreement that may undermine the right to have access to essential medicines and medical technologies if such an agreement were to be negotiated.
Trade representatives in both countries say that the agreement would help the economy of the five Southern African countries by providing duty-free access to the U.S. market. But Tanya Van Mielies, an organizer with the Congress of South African Trade Unions, says that is false.
Of our goods in 1995 that we exported to the U.S., 99.6% of goods we exported to the U.S. got in duty-free. But in fact, if we look at the 0.4% of goods that potentially could go into the U.S., it's in a limited number of product lines, and perhaps one could find a way to look at some kind of agreement on that. You certainly don't need a full free trade agreement, and asking us to open up services and potentially undermine our future development path for 0.4% of trade really isn't on.
The White House has until June 2007 to use its Trade Promotion Authority to fast-track all trade agreements. The authority allows the administration to submit trade deals to the U.S. Congress in an up-and-down vote with no opportunity for amendments. Selena Masuda, FSRN, in Washington, D.C.
On April 24th, voters in India-administered Kashmir will choose representatives for four open seats in the Legislative Assembly. There's been some violence as anti-India guerrillas attempt to disrupt the process. FSRN's Shanawaz Khan has more from Kashmir.
Suspected guerrillas attacked former Speaker of Jammu and Kashmir Legislative Assembly, Ali Muhammad Nayak, on Monday in Thral Township of Kashmir. One of Nayak's security guards was killed in the attack, and the former Speaker received serious injuries as a bullet ripped off his jaw. Sheikh Waiz Ahmed is the Deputy Inspector General for South Kashmir Zone.
He was here to attend the marriage ceremony of one of his relatives. I think he was attacked because of the upcoming elections. Militants try to do things like this during the elections to unnerve the process.
The attack came 3 days after 7 serial blasts rocked Srinagar, creating panic among the residents. 5 people were killed and 40 injured as suspected guerrillas lobbed grenades at 7 places in Srinagar on Friday. Soon after the blasts, police arrested 9 suspects, claiming they had connections to the explosions. The arrests triggered protests by local people, claiming that those arrested had nothing to do with the attacks. Jammu and Kashmir has 2 capitals, Srinagar the summer capital, Jammu the winter capital. Every year, the offices move and the secretariat is shifted, along with all the physical files, employees, ministries, between the two capitals. It is a legacy of Dogra Maharajas that ruled Jammu and Kashmir and is traditionally called Darbar Mu. Officials in Kashmir relate the violence to onset of summers. Gopal Sharma is the Director General of Police in Jammu and Kashmir.
It is related to onset of summer. You know, the offices are moving, there's political activity in the air. So occasionally the militants try to do something, and they succeed also.
Despite the recent grenade attacks, officials say the graph of violence is lower than the last few years. Indian Home Secretary V.K. Dugal, who was in Srinagar, today said the violence level was lower than last year. Dugal, however, accused Pakistan of supporting militant activities from across the border. Meanwhile, families of some of the people killed on Friday say their kin were killed by the police and not by grenade splinters as claimed by the government. Protesters rocked many places in Srinagar over the weekend as people refused to buy the government version of the story. Mudassir Pare was killed in one of the incidents. Mudassir's father Farooq Pare say he witnessed the attack on his son by the Central Reserve Police Force. Pare and his son were shopping in the Hari Singh High Street of Srinagar on Friday when the shooting occurred.
I was backing up my car towards the shop from where we had made the purchases. My son went to open the car trunk to put the purchases in there. Meanwhile, some troopers came toward him and shot at him in the leg. They also shot at the tires and a paint box we had purchased, and it caught fire.
Pare says after he got out of the car, he was caught and taken inside the nearby bunker, wherein he was ruthlessly beaten. Later, he was rescued by the local police.
I had no idea of what had happened to my son, if he was injured or worse. I was taken by the local police when I heard a wireless message about the death of my son.
The Central Reserve Police Force denies the allegation, saying they had not fired any shots. Pare's family said there were bullet marks visible on Mudassir's body. His relatives, who had rushed to claim his body from the hospital, say they were made to sign some blank papers by the police. Muhammad Yasin is the cousin of Mudassir.
We were not in a clear state of mind and were asked to sign some papers. We just wanted to get the body for burial. But the senior doctor who examined him did acknowledge there were bullet marks and not grenade splinters.
Later, the family was surprised to hear the police version. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Shahnawaz Khan.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and KPFK in Los Angeles. Simba Rousseau and Monica Lopez produce our newscast. Shannon Young is our headlines editor. Leanne Caldwell is our Washington editor. Our technical production team includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. For archives of this or any other FSRN newscast or documentary, you can check out our website at www.fsrn.org. You can email us your comments or story ideas at comments@fsrn.org. In Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert, sitting in for Auto Bogato.